It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Thanks for spending part of your day with us.
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay.
This has been an unprecedented term for the U.S. Supreme Court. With a firm majority of five conservative justices, the nation's high court has considered cases with decisions likely to reverberate across all areas of American life and governance for decades. First Amendment issues of religious freedom, Second Amendment concerns about the regulation of gun ownership, core governance matters about the power of federal agencies to enforce regulations, and of course, the question of whether the Constitution protects the right to seek and choose an abortion. The court is, of course, issuing these rulings while still in the shadow of a shocking leak of a draft opinion, and now with armed guards providing 24-hour protection at the private residences of justices. James Remoser is editor of SCOTUS Blog, an outlet tracking and analyzing cases before the Supreme Court. Thanks for being here, James.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Okay, obviously, Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Organization is the big one we are still waiting on. Can you give us a sense of your thinking on this?
Yeah, that's right. Like the rest of the nation, I'm certainly awaiting this opinion probably more than others. It is, of course, a challenge to a Mississippi law that bans abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. But over the course of the litigation, the case has become a direct test to whether Roe versus Wade remains the law of the land and whether the constitutional right to abortion at the federal level will remain standing. Of course, a couple months ago, there was a leaked draft opinion that showed that at least initially and privately, five justices were prepared to issue a ruling directly overturning Roe versus Wade and abortion rights at the federal level. That, of course, is not a final opinion of the court. And on rare occasions, sometimes votes do change as negotiations continue while the justices are debating the final opinion. And so that's where things stand. And certainly when the Dobbs opinion comes down, I think you're going to see a ton of attention on the court, as you already have in the past few weeks. And the ramifications will be really hard to overstate because dozens of states are prepared to entirely roll back abortion rights if they haven't already done so once Dobbs is handed down.
I have one more question on Dobbs around timing, and I'm not asking you to look into a crystal ball here, but rather if there is anything relative to previous decisions of this magnitude in terms of when they tend to show up in the court's release of decisions. Does it tend to be earlier, middle, or later, or isn't there a historical pattern to that?
Historically, cases of this magnitude come down at the very end of the term, typically the very last day of the term, or maybe sometimes the last week of the term, or in some cases, the final 2 weeks of the term. But usually they tend toward the very, very last minute. And that's because with cases of this magnitude, justices care the most about them, and they work right up until the last minute to finalize the majority opinion and the dissents. There's a ton of negotiation behind the scenes. And so with this court, anything is possible as far as timing, but typically the big cases, they come down right at the end. We now are entering the home stretch of the Supreme Court term on Tuesday. And so this case really could come down at any time.
Let's talk about West Virginia versus EPA. How important is this case from an environmental and a regulatory standpoint?
It's potentially very important. It depends on what the court does. This is a case challenging the ability of the Environmental Protection Agency to pass broad regulations to combat climate change. And if the court issues a broad ruling, as some red states and the coal industry have asked, it really could hamstring the ability of that agency to make rules on climate change. And indeed, a ruling could even potentially hamstring many other federal agencies to pass regulations and policies affecting all sorts of areas of government. Now, that being said, There are many issues regarding jurisdiction and other technical problems in the litigation. So under normal circumstances, I would expect, because of those technical and jurisdictional problems, the court would not issue a sweeping decision, and in fact might not even decide the merits of the case. Now, again, this court is somewhat unique compared to, the makeup of the court in past years and past decades. So anything is possible. But I think, you know, a narrow ruling that sort of punts on this issue is very possible nonetheless. Of course, I think we will continue to see litigation about climate change and the power of the EPA to regulate it coming up. So even if we don't see a broad ruling on the merits this term, stay tuned.
Okay, so I want to stick with this one for just a moment. Do I hear you saying that it could affect the capacity of federal government agencies to regulate, full stop?
Well, yes, that's right. To certainly pass broad and sweeping regulations. And that's because the case at its heart is not just about climate change. It's about the power of the EPA and the power of federal agencies writ large. And it involves this, you know, sort of complex legal doctrine known as the major questions doctrine. And the basic issue is whether a federal agency can regulate in an area that is considered a so-called major policy area if Congress hasn't been crystal clear about exactly what it wants the agency to do. And there's a lot of problems with that doctrine because, for example, who defines what a major policy area is? Well, the answer is that the Supreme Court does. And another question is, you know, who defines when Congress is crystal clear or when Congress is so ambiguous that a federal agency might not have the power to pass policies? But this current Supreme Court, we've seen in case after case, is highly skeptical of the power of federal administrative agencies, and they've already begun to cut away at agencies' power. And so, yes, it will affect not just the EPA, but it'll affect agencies' ability to regulate in the areas of healthcare, of food safety, of workplace safety rules, and, you know, really across the administrative state.
Let's talk about state power in this case around gun laws. The nation's eyes are still very much on Uvalde. SCOTUS is expected to decide a case regarding New York's state license requirements regarding concealed carry. Can you walk us through that a bit?
It's a challenge to New York's concealed carry regulations. And basically, several New York state residents have challenged the gun control law there as violating the Second Amendment, and specifically the Second Amendment right to bear arms. So, you know, if you remember from your, you know, civics class, the Second Amendment says that people have a right both to keep arms and bear arms. And in a case about a decade ago, the Supreme Court sort of interpreted that first phrase, keeping arms, very broadly, and said that in general, citizens have a right to keep weapons in their own homes for their self-protection. Now, this case is sort of the follow-on to that. It's about bearing arms, that is, the ability to sort of carry guns outside the home for self-protection without having to show a very special need or a sort of a personalized need for self-protection, which is what the New York law requires and which is what many other state and city gun control measures require. But these citizens are saying those gun control regulations go too far and they shouldn't have to show that special need. They should be able to carry a concealed handgun without making that heightened showing.
All right, let's talk a bit about religious freedom here. We just did a little Second Amendment. Let's pop back up to that First Amendment. Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. This is the case about the football coach.
That's right. This case comes to us out of Washington State. There was a public high school football coach who was in the habit of kneeling at the 50-yard line on the field after games and praying. And some students would join with him in his prayer. And the school district asked him to stop, basically. And the reason the school district asked him to stop was because the district felt that some students might feel coerced into joining him in prayer. It was a Christian prayer, And the school district felt that under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which prevents government, including public schools, from establishing or endorsing religion, the district didn't want to be seen as endorsing any religious practice, and they didn't want students to feel coerced into joining him. And the coach responded that free speech and freedom to exercise religion don't disappear inside the schoolhouse gate, that he has a First Amendment right, both a free speech right and a sort of freedom of religion right, to exercise his own religion, even in a school setting. And so that's what the challenge is about. If the court rules in favor of the coach, that will open the door to more religious practice within schools, I think, by teachers.
How straightforward is that case? Are there strong predictions among writers and analysts at SCOTUS blog about this one?
So I have to say, this is actually not straightforward at all. And that's because although the legal issue sounds kind of simple, there are significant debates about the underlying facts. Okay, so the coach himself describes his practice as briefly kneeling to say a silent private prayer. And the school district says that's not what was going on at all, that there were crowds of 10 or 20 or 30 people all joining him with these prayers. They became a significant public spectacle. They became very disruptive. Students did feel coerced to join. So like sort of the underlying debate really changes how one sees the case and how one is likely to analyze the case. Typically, the Supreme Court is not really a fact-finding court. That's supposed to be left for lower courts, and the Supreme Court is supposed to decide only the legal issues. But as this case has come up to the justices, there are really sharp disagreements about the facts before you even get to the legal analysis. And so it's hard to predict what the justices will do with that. The oral argument was pretty complex for that reason, and you sort of saw the justices struggle with the fact that there are these disagreements. Now, that being said, the 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, we've seen has been highly accommodating of religious rights claims from people who want to practice their religion. So if I were a betting person, I would expect some sort of ruling on behalf of the coach.
We're going to take a quick break right here, back with more on the Supreme Court and upcoming and recent decisions here on The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And while we are still waiting for a number of big decisions from the Supreme Court, we've already seen some important opinions come out this term. Joining me once again to walk us through them is James Remoser, editor of SCOTUS blog. James, let's talk about some of the cases that, while all eyes have been sort of trained on Dobbs, have nonetheless come out. U.S. versus Vallejo Madero. Can you walk us through that one?
That case has been a little bit under the radar, and it was decided a couple months ago, but I think it's actually pretty important. Basically, it involves a federal program known as Supplemental Security Income. This is different from Social Security. This is essentially a safety net program that provides cash benefits to older Americans, people who are blind or disabled, who can't support themselves. And what Congress did in this program is it made these benefits available to residents of all 50 states, but it excluded residents of Puerto Rico, even though, of course, residents of Puerto Rico are American citizens. And one such resident of Puerto Rico, Mr. Vallejo Madero, who actually previously lived in New York City and received these SSI benefits, lost the benefits when he moved to Puerto Rico to be with his family. And so he challenged the exclusion of Puerto Rico from the benefits. under the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. And he basically says equal protection means that Congress has to treat all American citizens equally. And this came up to the court, and the court held 8-1 that Vallmadar was wrong, that actually Congress can exclude Puerto Rico from this sort of benefit. And the ruling does open the door for the federal government to treat Puerto Rico and the other territories differently in all sorts of federal programs. Justice Sonia Sotomayor was the lone dissenter in that case.
Let's talk about another one around federal oversight, which we were talking about in the context of the EPA case. Egbert versus Brulé, what happened there?
Yeah, so this is a case involving a federal border control agent who was attempting to question a suspected non-citizen near the U.S.-Canada border outside an inn. And the innkeeper intervened and asked the Border Patrol agent to leave his property. A sort of a dispute arose, and the innkeeper kind of claims that the Border Patrol agent, you know, wouldn't leave and sort of violated his Fourth Amendment rights, and then later on sort of retaliated him by prompting an IRS investigation in a sort of way that was a violation of his First Amendment rights. So the innkeeper sued the Border Patrol agent for a First Amendment retaliation claim and for a Fourth Amendment violation for an illegal seizure, an illegal search and seizure. And so the basic question is whether citizens have a right to sue federal officers for constitutional violations. Now, there's a federal statute that allows people to sue state officials, like, you know, state or local police officers for constitutional violations. But there's no similar statute to sue federal officers. But there is this old case in the Supreme Court in which the Supreme Court basically said, you have an implied right to sue federal officers for constitutional violations. However, over the decades, the Supreme Court has cut back and limited that case very strongly. And in this case, the Supreme Court again ruled against the innkeeper, said he does not have a right to bring these claims because it involves a special context involving border enforcement. And basically, it again has, it's almost diminished that prior case almost into oblivion, to the extent that, you know, most people now feel people don't really have a right to sue for civil damages if a federal employee violates their constitutional rights, which is very interesting, because if you have a right, it would seem like you should also have a remedy to enforce that right. Mm-hmm. But the Supreme Court has consistently said in the federal context, when it comes to federal officers, you can't sue for money damages for constitutional violations.
I do want to take a look at just one more case here, and that's Ramirez versus Collier, around this question of a Texas death row prisoner. And again, the questions of religious rights in that context.
Yeah, exactly. So this was a case that was decided, you know, again, a few months ago. There is a man in Texas on death row, and he brought a religious rights claim because he wanted to have his minister with him, physically present with him in the execution chamber while he was being executed. And indeed, he wanted his minister to be able to pray aloud and place his hands on him as he was being put to death. He said this was a very important component of his religious faith. And the state of Texas said, no, we're not going to allow that. We're not going to allow you to have your minister, you know, sort of lay hands on you or pray above you during the execution. So the prisoner brought a religious rights claim, and the Supreme Court ruled in his favor and said that he did indeed have a right to have his pastor with him at his execution. And I think what you see in that case is a tension between this Supreme Court's disfavoring of claims from people on death row versus the court's accommodation of, you know, religious liberty claims. And here, religious liberty won out.
And so it's exactly at that tension, because this was also an 8-1 decision, which it does feel on such a divided court that an 8-1 decision feels, you know, perhaps a bit surprising. And so One of the key questions I just want to understand is, we're sort of at this point in the calendar. Is there anything that binds them together? Is there a way that we can describe what this court is? And perhaps most critically, for the current Chief Justice, is the thing that this court is the thing that the Chief Justice wants it to be?
Yeah. So John Roberts, you know, is a very enigmatic man. I think it's hard to answer that question. I think, frankly, this is a very basic answer, but it's the truest answer. The overarching theme of this term is that this is an extremely conservative court, and it reaches conservative outcomes in the vast majority of politically salient cases.
James Ramoser, editor of SCOTUS blog. I know it's a very busy time for you. And again, thank you for taking time for The Takeaway.
Thanks so much.